So my name is Jesse and I am a cocaine addict. Thank you, Chris, for asking me to come here and share my story today. AR was one of the many treatment centers that I went to and went through, and I'll get into that. But I do want to share that I have been sober since November 16th of 2005 through God's grace and the 12 steps of Cocaine Anonymous. I introduced myself as a cocaine addict because ultimately that's what led to me hitting bottom. But I'm the type of addict that if you put anything in front of me, I'll take it and then I'll ask you what it does to me. In Cocaine Anonymous, our basic text is the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I will refer to that book a lot. It is, the book that has had the most impact on my life. And it is the book by which I live my life. And so, you know, in this book, it talks about, you know, that we disclose in a general way what it was like, what happened and what it's like today. You know, and chapter about more about alcoholism, it talks about step one, and it says we have to concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. You know, and that's, for me, that story, that part of step one took me, many, many years. You know, I was first introduced to treatment, I think at the age of 17, I went to my first detox center, because I couldn't stop drinking. You know, I, from the very first time that I drank when I was around a teenager, I guess 15 or 16, I had blackouts and I had consequences from the very, very beginning. You know, the story for me is always the same. You just got to change the places and the people. But the truth is that I put substances into my body. I black out. I get vulgar. I want to fight. And then that institution is asking me to leave. You know, this for me repeated for numerous of years in every institution that I've ever been in. You know, I had a very, very traumatic childhood. And as a result of that, I ended up in a children's home at the age of 15. And that's really where it just all began for me. And so from that very institution, I met a cousin there. I got drunk. I got high. I came home in a blackout. I beat up my house mother and I was asked to leave and taken back to that abusive environment. I went to the next children's home. I did the same thing. I went to the next girl's home. I did the same thing. I have been asked to leave every treatment center that I've been in because I just, you know, without a spiritual program, without a connection with the God of my understanding, without the 12 steps, I basically don't, I don't have any manners. I don't know if I was just absent that day in kindergarten when they taught you how to get along with other people. But until I came in and was willing to take a good look at myself, I just basically just did, like, I just had no concept or awareness of self and how my behaviors affected other people. And so that's basically how I lived, I believe, the first 32 years of my life. And so, you know, the Big Book talks about how, you know, in Bill's story, how his, you know, continuous, you know, his drinking became continuous and, you know, was like day and night. And that's basically, you know, how my disease progressed. I do not recall a time whenever that I was ever like a weekend warrior or a continuous hard drinker. I just remember being, if I look back and I'm honest with myself, I drank with the intention to get messed up, and I used with the intention to stay high, 24/7. I don't know how old I was, but I remember I was at a gas station somewhere and someone asked me, "Don't you have any goals?" And my response was real simple. And my answer was, "Yes, my goal is to get more effed up today than I did yesterday." And I meant it when I said it. I had no doubts about it. You know, I also grew up with, in a very religious home. Interestingly enough, I lived with two grandparents for the first 9 years of my life, and they were on very opposite ends of the spectrum. And the religion to me is just really, it's really irrelevant, you know. And what I got from that was that when I came into the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous, I just was very, very angry at God. And fortunately, when I came in here, you know, I was given the opportunity to develop a relationship with the God of my own understanding, you know, and for that, I'm truly, truly grateful. And that's been a really, really huge relief, because when I got here, they told me if I was able to stay sober and get a God in my life, that anything was possible. You know, and my life today looks nothing like I thought it would when I came calling in the door 15 and a half years ago. You know, I've had many, many consequences due to the disease of my addiction. You know, and today I live a life that is beyond my wildest dreams. You know, in the midst of my disease, I got married twice. Once, the first time when I was 18, to a guy that wasn't so wonderful. And, you know, I found myself pregnant. And that's why I ended up getting married. And fortunately, in that pregnancy, I was able to quit drinking and drugging pretty on in my pregnancy. You know, and I gave birth to this baby. And I remember I wanted more than anything was to be a good mom and, you know, to breastfeed this baby for a year. And you know, I stopped using substances, I guess, at that point for like 15 months. You know, and the big book talks about that, you know, we forget the pain and suffering and humiliation against the first, the pain and suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. And we're without defense against the first drink, you know, because I hadn't drank or used for all that time. You know, I thought, you know, I could drink and I could, you know, use safely again. And so, you know, I never graduated from high school, but after having that baby, I had gotten to, I had gone and gotten my GED and I thought, you know, I can just have a couple of beers and everything will be okay. You know, and little did I know that probably within 2 or 3 days, I was just where I had left off. You know, I managed to escape that marriage somehow. I really don't remember all the details because I was always in a drunken fog. But before I got divorced from husband number one, because of my religious upbringing, you know, that I was raised to grow up and get married and have babies. Before I divorced husband number one, I already had my sights set on husband number two. And I ended up having to divorce husband number one because I found myself pregnant with husband number two's baby. At this point, I think I'm 22 years old and I've had a harder time quitting drinking and drugging. And at this point, my disease had progressed to alcohol and smoking weed on a regular basis and doing all forms of hallucinogens. And at month 8 of my pregnancy, that I had to induce my labor because I was having some complications. You know, and fortunately, you know, I had this baby and I remember more than anything that I wanted, you know, I felt like this was another chance to, like, you know, be a good mom and to slow down because, you know, I had a few months of sobriety and a friend of mine came over and it was a month before my 23rd birthday and she wanted to take me out for my birthday. And I thought, you know, I can drink for a night and everything will be okay. And I got to tell you, I started celebrating my 23rd birthday, I think 2 weeks before that birthday and I did not breathe a sober breath. And that was in 1995 that I started partying and I did not breathe a sober breath until November of 1998 when I got arrested the first time for possession of a controlled substance and I think a pot charge and a paraphernalia charge. You know, I really wanted more than anything to not be the mother to my kids that my mother was to me, but because I'm an addict and an alcoholic, once I put those substances into my body, the truth is that I don't know when I'm going to stop. And really the truth is that for me, I don't stop until the handcuffs come on. And that has been my story on more than one occasion. Several months later, I had gotten arrested on a sealed indictment for a delivery charge, you know, and you would think that that would be enough for me to have a wake up call and for me to get my act together. And it really, it wasn't. It was another reason for me to continue to get high because I mean, I was just really looking for any excuse to continue to put substances in my body. You know, and I'll never forget that day that I was arrested in front of my child, you know, and she hasn't forgotten. She was three years old at the time. And because I was facing the charge, you know, my friends thought it would be a good idea for me to go to rehab. And so now it's 1999. And I think I went to detox like 17 times. I had really good insurance and I was married to a really, really good man. And he was a really good husband and a really good provider. And I was a horrible wife. I mean, you can look at me and probably imagine all the reasons why. But I was in such complete denial about who I was. And I was in a constant state of being drunk and high and coked out all the time and stoned or whatever it was. Whatever you would give me, I would just use it till I just didn't want to feel. I didn't want to face the truth about who I was and what I was. And I think I went to detox about 17 times and I just could not. I don't know if I wasn't paying attention or if I was just going through the motions to try to beat drug charges, but I guess I just didn't listen or I tuned it out when they would, that I couldn't take the first drink or I couldn't take the first hit or I couldn't pop the first pill or I couldn't snort the first line. I don't know what the problem was, but I would get out of detox. And for some reason, I thought it would be okay to smoke a blunt, to smoke a joint or to take a pill or to drink a beer. I just thought I had to lay off of the hard stuff. And I believe this. I think for all of 1999, or at least half of 1999, because I did manage to get sober. I think somewhere in 1999, I had a sobriety date, I believe, like in late summer. And I was also going to get sentenced later that year, so I kind of knew that I had to get it together. So ultimately, they dropped all the charges but one. I pled out to one, and I was going to be on probation. I ended up going to a long-term treatment center, and I think somewhere along the way, I did hear that message that I couldn't pick up the first one, you know, but what I didn't do was I didn't continue to follow through with working the 12 steps of Cocaine Anonymous as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so, you know, I did manage to stay sober that time for 34 months. And I got to tell you, for the first year of that sobriety, I lived in Houston. I had a sponsor. I worked some steps. I went to some meetings in CA. I did some service work, such as, you know, like worked a coffee bar and stuff like that. I got to go to conventions and I got to have a good time, but there was just some things that I was unwilling to do. You know, I was really unwilling to do a complete third step, like a thorough one where I was willing to give God every aspect of my life. You know, it's like, God, he can have all these things and you can definitely have those baby children of mine. But it's like, I was unwilling to give God complete control of my finance and the romance, right? Those are the two things that, you know, in my past have been a struggle for me. And I just was unwilling to completely let those go. And I remember when I did the fourth step with my sponsor and when it came down to sit down and do that fifth step, there was just some things that I was unwilling to talk about. But see, I can tell you that I wasn't really like all about step three and I wasn't really all about steps four and five. But the truth is that, you know, I really hadn't had a real step one experience, right? Because if I was really convinced that I was powerless over cocaine and all mind altering substances, I would have been willing to do anything, you know, because I hadn't done that and I really wasn't there with it. And I wasn't honest with myself about being completely powerless and that my life had become unmanageable. I really wasn't willing to work the rest of the 12 steps. And so I think at around 34 months of sobriety while being on felony probation, I had a dirty UA and the state of Texas loved me so much that they decided that they wanted to give me a place to live and give me some treatment. And so they sent me away to Safe P. And I got to tell you, it was life-changing. It was so life-changing and so hard and brutal. And I smile when I say it because ultimately I'm really grateful for that experience. But while I was there, I wanted to escape so desperately that I used cocaine while I was on that unit. I mean, looking back, it's kind of like funny, but it's not. But I was so powerless and I am so powerless. And at the time I was in such denial. But there's a prison guard 15 feet away from me in the pipe chase and I'm snorting cocaine in my little prison cubicle. But for some reason, I am still not convinced that I'm a drug addict. You are not going to tell me that I'm a drug addict. Now, I will tell you that I'm a drug addict to get what I want, but really I'm a criminal and a drug dealer. So there's just this manipulation about me and I'm just unwilling at this time still yet after all my consequences to be honest and tell you the truth about myself. And so that's a free world charge. And when that happens, you get to go to this nice little lovely hotel at the prison inside the prison. And it's called administrative segregation. I can't really tell you how long I spent in there. I don't remember. And I don't know if I don't remember because it was traumatic or if it was just so boring because I had nothing in there, not a book, not a TV, not a snack, nothing. And before I knew it, I was being hauled back to my county. But I knew the one way to get away with what I did was to cry the drug addict card to my judge. At this time, I am 29 years old. I'm still really young and I'm really cute and I have this beautiful, beautiful, long, curly ringlets of hair, you know, and I still, I'm still wearing makeup. Not that there's anything wrong with the way that I look now, but I knew how to be manipulative and I knew how to do what I needed to do to get what I wanted. And I did. And somehow I managed to convince the judge, because it would have been up to him as to whether or not, for me to get a new free world charge or to send me back to the Safe P unit. That was going to be the quickest way to go do my time. And to come out. And for some reason, he gave me some grace and saw something in me, I guess, that there was no way that I could have seen in myself and allowed me to go back and finish that. You know, and I was able to go back and face what I had done. And I got to tell you, the rest of my time there, which is, I guess, was approximately 8 months left of my time there, was hard. It was super hard and it was super harsh, you know. And I wish that I could tell you that I've been a good girl guy ever since and that I've been sober you know, but unfortunately I'm a hard-headed drug addict and alcoholic, and I learned my lessons hard, and that's not the case. You know, so I get out and it's 2003, you know, and so of course now I have a reason to celebrate. And so I decide that, you know, I'm going to hit it up and I'm going to party one more time. And how I managed to get out of that unscathed is beyond me. And so, of course, I run back into Cocaine Anonymous because, you know, I'm just fresh out and I don't want to go back. And so, you know, I come in and now I'm living in Austin, and, you know, my kids are living with husband number two. I already am out at this point, because I've decided it's not worth my sobriety. And of course, again, I get a sponsor. I'm living in sober living. I'm going to college, to become a chemical dependency counselor. I mean, everything in my life is great, you know, and there have been periods in my life, prior to now, you know, this time I've been able to maintain long-term sobriety where I wouldn't give up anything that I have in this life for $1 million, but I will trade it all in for some cocaine. And, I think I stayed sober that time for, 25 months. And I actually, I was working at Austin Recovery at the ranch. And, in the middle of all that, somewhere along the way, this husband that I had been married to for all those years, who ended up being my best friend and supporting me when I came out, even when my family turned their back on me, he was killed by a drunk driver. And my daughter, my youngest daughter, who's now 25, was in the car with him. She survived the accident, and he did not. And I was severely impacted by that accident. And I would not talk about it. I felt like, you know, I don't know why I was punishing myself or what the deal was, or I just thought I was so smart and knew everything because I was in counseling school. And, you know, I don't know what my hang up was, but the truth is that I wouldn't get honest about what was going on. And for me, honesty is the principle behind step one. And if I'm not being honest, I'm not working a good program. I'm not working a good step one. And so, I was working at the ranch, and I'll never forget that day. I walked into my boss's office. Her name was Donna, and I walked in and I said, I'm depressed. I have no business being here. And I just walked out of my job and I went home. And I think within 2 weeks of that, I picked up again. And I got to tell you, prior to that, I remember sitting in the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous, and I was literally the person that had been to administrative segregation. I would sit in the rooms of Cocaine Anonymous and I would look down my nose at the people around me because there were some things that I had never, ever done in my disease. I mean, I've been to the penitentiary, but of course I'm still better than you. This was my thought process, and I know it sounds crazy, but you know, my truth is my truth, and the truth is what keeps me free. And, you know, and I would judge people because I had never, spent a significant amount of money on drugs, and I had never stayed up for more than a day, and I had never left my kids, and I had never stuck a needle in my arm, and I had never done this, and I'd never done that. And, you know, it talks about in the big book that, you know, we always have some insane, trivial excuse for drinking, but it never makes sense in the light of the havoc that it creates. It makes about as much sense as a person with a headache who beats himself over the head with a hammer so that he doesn't feel the ache. And that's exactly what happened to me in August of 2005. I remember my kids, they were 9 and 13 or 10 and 14. I don't know. They're 4 years apart, and they used to always want to kill each other. They drove me insane. But this day, they really weren't doing anything really that bad. I just wanted to take a nap. I didn't have to work because of the life insurance money and from the auto accident money. It's not like it was a lot of money and I was rich or anything, but I was okay to not work for a little while. And I wanted to take complete advantage of that. Not only that, I was super, super entitled, and I thought I was really, really cute and people should just make it rain when I walked in the door. And I was lazy and I had no goals in life, no motivation, and I didn't want to do anything. And to top it off, I was depressed and I felt like the world owed me something, and I was super, super angry, and I wasn't honest with anybody about what was going on with me. And so my kids woke me up from a nap, and I got really, really pissed off. You know, and this disease is so cunning and so baffling. You know, because back in the day, I would party with my friend that took me to celebrate my birthday for that one night that lasted for like all those years. And we snorted a whole trailer house one time because she sold her trailer house, and we literally snorted that up like in a week. I called her and, you know, I convinced myself that I wasn't going to use like part of my brain, but I think the other part knew what was going on and what time it was. But I called her. I had a 2-hour drive. I'm living in Austin, Texas, down the street from the North Austin 24-Hour Club, the AA 24-Hour Group. And I have a 2-hour drive to funky old Eagle Lake, Texas, the Colorado County, the county I fell out of, the county I got in all that trouble in. And I call her and I tell her, I said, I'm going to come pick you up and we're going to go to the gay club and I'm going to be the designated driver, which is obviously a crock of crap, right? And then the next 30 minutes later, I call her up and I tell her, nope, I'm not going to be the designated driver. I'm going to pick you up and I'm going to hire us a driver because I'm going to drink. And then 30 minutes later, I call her up and tell her, no, you know what? Can you just get us an ounce of weed? And then the first thing I ask her when I knock on the door is, can you get us some cocaine? Well, I got to tell you, I never made it to the gay club or did any of that stuff, because once I put that cocaine in my body, I went to that, did the same thing I always do. I went to those ratchet cantina beer joints that I always went to when I was active in my disease. I started hustling on that pool table, and it's just like I got stuck. I got stuck back in those same places that I had been in the 1990s when I was still young and had that cue stick in my hand, wearing a mini skirt in heels. And it's like I spent a whole week there doing God only knows what. And ultimately, those things that I said that I would never, ever do, like stay up for days, stick needles in my arm and do all those crazy things, I did those, you know, and then some. And so, you know, most people go to Austin Recovery and it is so life changing that they want to go back and work at Austin Recovery. I worked at Austin Recovery and then I went back and got to be a client at Austin Recovery. And I say got to be a client because it was a privilege that I was able to go back and be a client there and get some treatment. You know, I was not the role model client. I've never been a role model client, anywhere that I've been, but I got to tell you that they loved me in spite of myself and my big mouth and all the rules that I broke, because if there was anything, any rule to break, you know, I broke it. And somehow, some way, I managed to get 14 months of treatment. And I got to tell you, if anybody needed treatment, it was me. You know, I just thought I was so smart and I thought that I knew everything. And I wish that I could tell you that, you know, I have been sober from that moment on, but it's still August of 2005 and I still am not quite convinced that I'm powerless over cocaine and all mind-altering substances. So while I was in outpatient treatment, I got kicked out of outpatient. And you know how they have that saying where if you get a resentment, having a resentment is like drinking poison, expecting someone else to die. And I got to tell you, that's exactly what happened. And I laugh because, I mean, I'm really lucky to be alive, number one, but it's kind of comical because I really believed it. And so I got kicked out of treatment because of my own big mouth and my own fault, you know, and I've had the opportunity as well to go back and make amends to Austin Recovery in more ways than one. And so I decided that I was going to drink, and in my mind, somehow Austin Recovery was going to feel bad and it was going to blow up or something to that effect. I mean, I was so dramatic. And that didn't happen at all. So I started drinking, and within 30 seconds, I wanted to shoot up. And so I went, you know, the one thing, it's like so crazy, the things that I paid attention to in the meetings, I learned in Austin that you can go to Runbergen 35 and buy all the crack that you can get. And so I was like, well, if you can buy crack on Runbergen 35, surely you can buy some cocaine. And so I found a lady of the streets and, you know, I said, the only thing I need is some cocaine. I want nothing else, but I do have two kids. If you can get me an ounce of coke, I'll buy you all the crack you want. Just call 911 because I have two kids. I can't die. And so she took me and we got what we needed. And after a few hours, I started getting really, really paranoid. And so I left her there. And I'm such a kind drug addict that I left her some money as well. And I went home and I started packing my bags. And I don't know where I thought I was going to go. But this woman that I still know in the program came home to my house. She's the one that took care of my kids when I was in residential treatment. You know, she started to lay into me and to tell me that I was wasting my life and throwing away the gifts that God gave me. And I'm like, F you, Roberta, F you. And I mean, I'm just cussing, you know, because I really had no defenses and I really had nothing to say because I knew she was absolutely right. So, of course, she was just striking a nerve with me. You know, I've been off paper for like, you know, 35 seconds and, you know, and so, and I'm using, right. And, you know, and then she says, you know what? People have enabled you your entire life. If you're going to get sober, you're going to do it this time because you want to, not because people are nagging you or telling you that you have to or whatever. You're going to do it because you want to. And so she finally leaves. And so there I am just stuck with me, my thoughts, my cocaine, and the mirror. And I look in the mirror and I see myself and I just see like this empty, dead shell of a, I don't even know if I was a human being, more like a demon, miserable excuse of a person that I have become that was supposed to do something with my life that had not. That kid that had been told my entire life that I had the potential to do anything. And here I was, 32 years old, that I didn't want to work. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to be responsible. I didn't want to be a mother. I didn't want to be a friend to anybody. I had been in and out of Cocaine Anonymous now since 1998. It's 2005. I didn't feel like my life was worth living. I am exactly what it talks about on page 52 of the big books. I can't control my emotional natures. I cannot make a living. I am of use to no one. I'm having problems with my personal relationships. In other words, I am just walking around sucking up air and giving nothing back to life at all. And somehow in a moment of, I don't know if it was insanity or clarity or a combination of the two, but I had a moment of desperation and I picked up the phone and I actually had a house phone and I called 911 and the lady on the line said, 911, what is your emergency? And I said, I need y'all to come get me because if you don't come get me, I'm going to kill myself with cocaine. I cannot stop sticking a needle in my arm. And she said, excuse me. I said, I need y'all to come get me. I cannot stop shooting up cocaine. And that woman stayed with me on the phone until the police and the ambulance came. There was this part of me that wanted to die, but there was this part of me that it's not that I wanted to die. I just no longer wanted to live the way that I was living. My disease had progressed to the point where I would line up 10 syringes of cocaine, shoot them up in one arm and do it again in the other arm. For me, it really wasn't about dying anymore. It's just I no longer wanted to live if I was going to continue to live and to shoot dope. And the last thing, and for me, I really believe my step one was when I told God, F-U-M-F-er, if I'm going to live and shoot cocaine, you just let me die and you let me die right now because I cannot live like this anymore. When I heard the ambulance was really, really close, I set down the phone and I walked outside. I mean, I already had been to prison, so obviously I knew a little bit about the law. And I remember them putting me in the ambulance. And I remember my last thought was, if I survive this, that I may never, ever be able like to be, you know, cognitively like function again because of the amount of cocaine that I had shot up in those last few minutes. And the next thing I remember is meeting some really nice social worker. Lady social workers are the best. And she says, you know, I don't know why I'm going to make this decision today, but you're not going to go to jail. And I'm not going to report you to CPS, but you need to call someone and you better make sure you call the right person. Because this, if this does happen again and you end up back in an emergency room because of this, she says your consequences next time will be more severe. And I got to tell you, my life has been completely different ever since that day. I called my sponsor. And at the time I had a big gay sponsor. And that's what I called her. Got to understand, I was still a little sick. And, you know, she was like 6'2". And I was very intimidated by her and a little bit scared. And that's probably exactly what I needed. She was an ex-IV drug user. She was a single parent. And she was also a chemical dependency counselor. And she was exactly what I needed, you know. And this woman took me through this book line by line, you know. And most importantly, she helped me get a relationship with the God that was only going to solve my drug problem, but helped me solve all my problems, you know. And finally, for the first time in my entire life, did I really actually believe that I was powerless over cocaine and all mind-altering substances and left to my own devices and without a God in my life and without you guys and without the steps that I was going to continue to use cocaine. And I probably wasn't going to die out there because I'm a survivor. I can live through anything. I mean, my childhood will show you that. I mean, I was just probably going to live out there forever. That was my biggest fear of living out there forever and shooting up cocaine and wanting so desperately to stop and not being able to. And, you know, and so my sponsor helped me to come to that realization, you know, and she helped me to get a God in my life. And I remember when I had my, you know, unofficial third step experience before doing that actual official third step prayer with my sponsor. I was dating this tech from the treatment center. And as I share my story, I know I've done a lot of things that aren't right, but this is my story. So my suggestion is to not do some of these things, because I really believe that I'm really fortunate to still be sober, but, and not necessarily fortunate. I think that I've done the work and I've developed a God that has been big enough to help me to overcome a lot of these things, you know, because one of my, a big part of my story is prior to this period of sobriety is that, you know, I have a history of, you know, using women, and I know, you know, once they fall in love with me, I take them for everything that they have. And then when I'm done, I just move on to the next. And so I'm dating this woman that was a tech at Austin Recovery, you know, and she said those magic words, and she told me that she really, really liked me, you know, and here I have like 30 seconds sober. And then something inside me was like, you know, this just isn't right. I know I cannot continue to act this way and treat people this way and stay sober, right? There had been this God conscience had started to develop inside of me, and me with my like 30 seconds sober, and I don't mean literally 30 seconds. I don't know how much time I had, but I remember the best that I could do was tell her, you know what? I forgot I had to be somewhere. And I remember I got in my car and I told the God of my understanding, because, you know, my favorite word for the God of my understanding when I first got sober was MF-er. And I was like, look, MF-er, if we're going to do things differently this time, I really need you to suit up and show up, because I just really can't do this by myself. Because really, you know, my MO is to just like stick around and hang out till, you know, I know she's going to want to kill me and start stalking me and stuff, and then burn out, not to burn out right now before I start doing some serious, serious harm. You know, and I know from that moment forward that, you know, maybe just maybe for the first time ever in a period of sobriety, I wasn't going to have to make amends to, like, you know, a bunch of ladies. You know, and for the first time ever, you know, then I did my, you know, third step prayer, like it talks about it in the big book, you know, and then the big book talks about next we launch on that vigorous course of action. It doesn't say that I sit around and mess around on my fourth step for the next 16, 17 weeks, you know, and that I lollygag around. It says I launch on that vigorous course of action, you know, and my sponsor had me write out all my columns. I didn't get to do no check boxes or nothing like that, you know, and I had to get down to the causes and conditions, you know, and I had to write out how these things were affected in my life. Then I had to, you know, get into that fourth column and take a look at my part. And when we did that fifth step, if I couldn't, if I had struggles with identifying my part, my sponsor made it very, very clear. And I got to take a look at those patterns in my life, you know. And then the big book tells us we go home and we do six and seven for that hour. And she had me do exactly what this big book says. I actually had to put my book on a shelf, and then I had to take my book off of the shelf, you know, and I got to spend that hour with God, you know. And then we go into steps eight and nine, you know, and there's a couple of significant amends that I like to talk about when I share my story. One of them is with my mother. My mother was very physically abusive and she did not protect me like she should have. But in my disease, I stole $100 from her. And when I went to make those amends, I asked her what I could do to make those right. You know, she wanted me to take her to buy her a pair of Harley Davidson boots. You know, and that was all fine and dandy. But the best part of that amends was, is that my mother also apologized to me for not being a good mother. You know, and today my mother is not mommy material. My mother doesn't have the ability to be mommy material. But today my mother's the best mother that she has ever been. She's been since that moment forward. And it's not because she's changed. It's because I've changed and my expectations of her have lowered. And since I've done 4 and 5, 6, 7, 8 and 9, I no longer expect my mother to be a mommy. I just let Consuela be Consuela. Consuela is a wonderful, funny alcoholic, active in her alcoholism, and I can appreciate her for exactly who she is, you know. And today I'm really, really grateful for that. Another amends is that when I was 16, my grandmother's guardian tried to sexually assault me. When I was in my 20s, I borrowed $1,000 from him, and I never ever intended on paying him back. But you know, the big book says we must not shrink, and we must go, be willing to go to any lengths. And so I found him in sobriety, you know. And I got to tell you, when I found him and he gave me the directions on how to pay him back that money, well, as soon as I let that money order go for that $1,000, I got to tell you, I bought myself $1 million worth of freedom. You know, when I came in, my credit score was in the 400s, you know, and at 14 months sober, I was able to buy a home and give my kids a stability that they had always wanted, that I had never, ever, ever been able to give them. Only their father had been able to do that. And for the first time ever at the age of 34, I was able to do that for my kids, you know. And then the big book talks about living the maintenance steps of 10 and 11 and 12. You know, today, there still continue to be a big part of my life, even at 15 and a half. Today, my service life has grown by leaps and bounds. I still sponsor other people. I've had the privilege of serving CA at the group level, the area level, and I still serve at the world level. I really don't know what I would do with all my time if I didn't serve at the capacity that I serve. It has been profound and life-changing. I spent the first 4 hours of my day serving CA at the world level. That's pretty much every Sunday, you know. And sometimes it's annoying. And sometimes I think, damn, I would like to sleep till noon on a Sunday. But the truth is that, you know, at this age, I probably wouldn't sleep till noon anyway. You know, there's a lot of things that CA has given me that I guess I could have gotten in kindergarten, but I had to come here to learn, you know, and that's just basically how to suit up and show up for life, you know, like, you know, to sit in the front row and to pay attention and to take good notes. And I've applied those same little things that I've learned here and the principles behind the steps and the traditions and the concepts. I've applied them to every area of my life and wherever I've taken those principles, I have been successful. You know, my kids are now 25 and 29. They love me and they adore me. My 29-year-old has an 8-year-old daughter that she trusts me with, and she calls me Ng for Ninja Grandma. She's not allowed to call me Grandma because I don't look like a grandma. And, you know, since she was born, I've been telling her that I was the number one grandma and I was her favorite grandma. And so she is convinced. I am so proud of that. you know, and if I keep doing what I'm doing one day at a time, she'll never, ever have to see the monster that my children, you know, had to see when they were kids, you know. And for my daughter to trust me with the life that she gave life to me is a privilege that is immeasurable. You know, the relationship that I have with my mother today means a lot to me. But because of Cocaine Anonymous and the way that y'all loved me, I've been able to love her exactly as she is. You know, when I got here, I didn't even want to be a mom, much less a daughter. And today, you know, I get to do both. Another thing that I've done the whole time I've been sober is I've been a very avid and active martial artist. Yesterday, I tested for my 4th-degree black belt, and my youngest daughter was my self-defense partner. You know, and for her to trust me in that manner and for her to allow me to punch her and kick her and sweep her and flip her and throw her over my shoulder and, you know, take her out by her legs and do all the things that she's, she allows me to do, is just something that, you know, I can't even put a price tag, you know, on what that means to me, you know. And I know I wouldn't have that today if it wasn't for what I've given to CA. Another great thing that's happened for me in CA is that I'm in a happy, committed, monogamous relationship with a woman who loves me exactly as I am. She doesn't want to try to change me. She knows that CA is my first love and that she comes after that. You know, I never, ever, ever thought that I would find that, you know, but because I have kept true to who I am in CA, you know, God has put someone in my life to love me exactly as I am. And the last thing that I want to share that has been absolutely mind-blowing is that, you know, because y'all have told me over and over again that if I got a God and I stayed sober and I was willing to help other people, that anything was possible. You know, when I got here, I had a GED and I was a LCDC intern, and I did get licensed in 2009. But when I was a kid, I always wanted to be a lawyer when I grew up. And so in 2007 or six, I went back to college. Because I went to LCDC school when you only needed, when you needed a certificate, you didn't have to have a degree. And I got into a relationship in early recovery, and we broke up, and she said, "You're smart. You should go to college." And I was like, "Oh, okay. Well, I'll go to college because I want to get the girl back." And it didn't work out that way. You know, God always has a better plan for me than I have for myself. And his plans are always far greater than I could ever, ever imagine. And so I started going to school. And at the time, I thought I wanted to be a social worker because social workers have always had such a great impact on my life. They've saved my life more than once. But really it was, you know, I had come to learn in the process of self-discovery in recovery that, you know, really what I wanted to be was I wanted to be an attorney, but people tell me it wasn't possible because of my criminal history or because of my background. And, you know, I was like, well, I'm going to go take this little discovery test at school and see what they think I should be. And so the discovery test told me I should either A, be a counselor, or B, be a lawyer. And I was like, well, I'm already a counselor and I don't want to do that. But I decided to put Cocaine Anonymous in the 12 steps and God to the test. And so I decided I was going to go to law school. And so with my being a single mom with two kids and the bills that I had and the things that I had going on in my service, it took me 8 years, but I got my bachelor's degree from Texas State in 2014. I majored in political science and a minor in criminal justice. And then in 2015, I started law school. And in 2018, I graduated. And today I'm a licensed attorney. I have my doctorate in jurisprudence. which is a big deal for a poor Mexican kid like me from the hood, you know. And I share that with y'all because I want to tell you that in sobriety, I don't care what A you choose. I don't care if it's C-A-A-A-N-A, whatever A. If your sobriety is first and your relationship with God is first, whatever. I mean, I really mostly call mine creator. I use God in generic terms because that's what we do here. But everything that I have put second, I have gotten first class. I'm here to tell you that dreams do come true if you stay sober and you're willing to give this thing everything you got. Even if you don't do it perfectly and you make mistakes along the way, as long as you're willing to pick yourself back up, stay on track, and keep your sobriety number one, I promise you, your life will be amazing. And if you forget and you need someone to remind you, you can call me and I will remind you. So with that, I'll be quiet. Thank you for listening. My name is Jesse and I am a cocaine addict.
Thank you, Jesse.
Jesse, that was amazing.
You're amazing.
You are amazing.
Awesome, awesome.
That was very helpful hearing about you.
Thank you.
I needed to hear that. You gave me motivation.